Louis DePayne was stationed on campus, posing as a student. He would ask one of the computer operators to mount a tape he provided onto the system's tape drive. Across town at the office of my friend Dave Harrison, I would connect to a VMS system called a RAMoff over a dial-up modem that had Louis's tape mounted on the drive. I would fill up the tape with as much VMS source code as would fit. Louis would then hand the operator another blank one and pass the written tape to Lenny DeCiccio. At the end of each session, Lenny would take all the new tapes to hide in a rented storage locker. We repeated this cycle until eventually we had 30 to 40 tapes containing the full VMS version 5 source code. While I was spending so much time at Harrison's, it occurred to me that a company called GTE Telenet, which had offices in the same building, operated one of the largest X25 networks, serving some of the biggest customers in the world. Maybe I could gain administrative access to their network and monitor customer traffic. Dave had previously picked the lock to the fireman's box and lifted the master key to the building. Late one night, Dave and I used the key to walk into the GTE Telenet offices just to look around. When I saw they used VMS, I was elated. I felt right at home. I discovered a VMS system with a node name of Snoopy. After poking around for a bit, I discovered that Snoopy was already logged into a privileged account, giving me full access to the system. The temptation was too great. Even though the Telenet people were in and out of the offices 24 hours a day, I sat down at the terminal and started to explore, looking at scripts and third-party applications to figure out what tools they had and how those tools could be used to monitor the network. Within a very short time, I figured out how to eavesdrop on customer network traffic. Then it hit me. The node had been named Snoopy because it allowed the technicians to monitor traffic on customer networks. It allowed them to snoop. I already had the X25 address to connect to the VMS system at the organic chemistry department at Leeds University, where Neil Clift studied, so I connected. I didn't have any login credentials. None of my guesses were correct. He was already logged into the system because of the time difference, saw my login attempts, and emailed the administrator of Snoopy to say that someone was trying to get into his university's system. Of course, I deleted the email. Though I didn't get into Leeds University that night, my efforts had laid the groundwork for targeting Clift later on that would prove to be a gold mine. Lenny and I fell into a battle of wits against each other. He was a computer operator at a company called VPA, and I had joined a company called CK Technologies in Newbury Park. We kept making bets on whether we could break into each other's computer systems that we managed for our employers. Whoever could hack into the VMS system at the other's company would get the prize. It was like a game of capture the flag, designed to test our skill at defending our systems against each other. Lenny wasn't astute enough to keep me out. I kept getting into his systems. The bet was always $150, the cost of dinner for two at Spago, the Beverly Hills restaurant of celebrity chef Wolfgang Puck. I had won this ongoing bet enough times that Lenny was starting to feel annoyed. During one of our all-night hacking sessions, Lenny started complaining that he never won the bet. I told him he could quit any time he wanted, but he wanted to win. His company had just installed a digital lock on the door to its computer room. Lenny challenged me to bypass the lock by guessing the code, knowing it would be almost impossible to do. "If you can't get in," he said, "you have to pay me $150 right now, tonight." I told him I didn't want to take his money because it would be too easy, and then I added that he'd be upset with himself afterwards since I was always going to win, no matter what. These taunts made him even more anxious for me to accept the bet. Actually, it would have been difficult for me to win it straight up, but dumb luck came to my rescue. As I was working on Lenny's terminal, hacking into Digital's network, I spotted a wallet on the floor under his desk. I accidentally dropped my pen, then bent over to get it and stuffed the wallet into my sock. I told Lenny I had to take a leak. Inside the wallet, I found a slip of paper with the code for the digital door lock written on it. I couldn't believe it. Lenny was such a clever hacker, but he couldn't remember a symbol number? And he'd been foolish enough to write down the code and leave it in his wallet? It seemed so preposterous that I wondered if he was setting me up. Had he planted the wallet just to jerk my chain? I went back to his desk, replaced the wallet, and told him he'd have to give me an hour to guess the door code. We agreed that the only rule was that I couldn't break the lock. Anything else was fair game. A few minutes later, he went downstairs to get something. When he came back, he couldn't find me. He searched everywhere, then finally unlocked the door to the computer room. I was sitting inside, typing on the VMS console, logged in with full privileges. I smiled at him. Lenny was furious. "You cheated!" he shouted. I stuck out my hand. "You owe me $150." When he resisted, I said, "I'll give you a week." It felt great to knock the ego of the self-important Lenny down a few notches. He didn't pay and didn't pay. I kept giving him extensions, then told him I was going to charge him interest. Nothing. Finally, more as a joke than anything else, I called accounts payable at his company and pretended to be from the IRS's wage garnishment division. "Do you still have a Leonard DeCicco working there?" I asked.
"Yes, we do," said the lady on the other end.
"We have a garnishment order," I said. "We need you to withhold his pay." The lady said she'd have to have authorization in writing. I told her, "You'll have a fax on Monday, but I'm giving you official notice to withhold all paychecks until you receive further documentation from us." I thought Lenny might be a little inconvenienced, but no worse than that. When no fax arrived on Monday, payroll would just give him his money. When the people from accounting told Lenny about the IRS call, he knew instantly who'd been behind it. But he was so over the top, out of control, furious, that he lost all sense of reason and did a really stupid thing. He went to his boss and told him that the two of us had been hacking into DEC from VPA's offices. His boss didn't call the cops. Instead, he and Lenny together called the security staff at DEC and told them who'd been plaguing them over the past several months. Eventually, the FBI was called in and its agents set up a sting. Personnel from the FBI and Digital Equipment Corporation set up camp at VPA prior to one of our late-night hacking sessions. They placed monitoring software on VPA's computer that would record everything we did. Lenny was wearing a wire to capture our conversations. That night, my target was Leeds University in England. After earlier identifying Neil Clift as one of Digital's main sources of information about VMS security bugs, I wanted to get into the VMS system in Leeds's organic chemistry department, where Clift had an account. At one point, I sensed that something a bit weird was going on with Lenny and asked him, "Is everything all right? You're acting strange." He said he was just tired, and I shrugged off his odd behavior. He was probably petrified I'd figure out what was really happening. After several hours of hacking, we called it quits. I wanted to keep going, but Lenny said he had to get up early. Several days later, I got a call from Lenny, who said, "Hey, Kevin, I finally got my vacation pay. I have your money. Come on over." 2 hours later, I rolled into the small ground floor parking garage of the building where VPA had its offices. Lenny was standing there, not moving. He said, "I need to get the VT100 terminal emulator software to make a copy for a friend," referring to software on disks he knew I had in the car. It was already 5 o'clock p.m., and I told him I hadn't eaten all day and was starving, and even offered to buy him dinner. He kept insisting. I wanted to get the hell out of there. Something felt wrong, but finally I gave in and, leaving the motor running, stepped out of the car to get the disks. "You know that feeling in your stomach when you're about to get arrested?" Lenny taunted. "Well, get ready." The whole garage was suddenly filled with the sounds of car engines. Cars shot out at us from what seemed like every direction, stopping in a circle around us. Guys in suits jumped out and started screaming at me, "FBI! You're under arrest! Hands on the car!" If Lenny had staged all this just to scare me, I thought, it was an impressive display. "You guys aren't FBI. Show me your ID." They pulled out their wallets and flipped them open. FBI badges all around me. The real thing. I looked at Lenny. He was dancing in a little circle of joy, as if he were celebrating some kind of victory over me. "Lenny, why would you do this to me?" As an agent handcuffed me, I asked Lenny to call my mom and tell her I'd been arrested. The bastard didn't even do that one last small bit of kindness for me. I was driven by two agents to the Terminal Island Federal Prison. I'd never seen anything like this outside of a movie or a television show. Long rows of open cells with guys hanging their arms out of the bars. Just the sight of it made me feel like I was dreaming, having a nightmare.
But the other prisoners surprised me by being cool and friendly, offering to lend me some stuff that was sold in the commissary and the like. A lot of them were white-collar guys. But I couldn't shower. I felt disgusting by the time some FBI agents finally picked me up and took me to FBI headquarters in West Los Angeles, where they took a mugshot of me. I knew I looked a mess, unshowered, uncombed, wearing the same clothes I'd been in for 3 days and having slept badly each night on a small cot. At least that picture was to give me some small comfort at a crucial time later on. After being held over the weekend, I was taken before Magistrate Veneta Tassopoulos for my initial detention hearing on Monday morning, expecting to be released on bail. I was assigned a court-appointed lawyer who asked if I'd been a fugitive. It turned out he'd already talked to the prosecutor, who told him I'd fled to Israel back in 1984, which wasn't true. Once the hearing began, I sat there in disbelief as the court got an earful from the prosecutor, Assistant U.S. Attorney Leon Weidman. Weidman told the judge, "This thing is so massive, we're just running around trying to figure out what he did." Among other things, he said that I had hacked into the NSA and obtained classified access codes, disconnected my former probation officer's phone, tampered with a judge's TRW report after receiving unfavorable treatment, planted a false news story about Security Pacific National Banks having lost millions of dollars after I had an employment offer withdrawn, repeatedly harassed and turned off the phone service of actress Christy McNichol, hacked into police department computers, and erased my prior arrest records. Every one of these claims was blatantly false. The allegation that I had hacked into the NSA was totally ridiculous. On one of the floppy disks seized by the Santa Cruz police was a file labeled NSA.txt. It was the WHOIS output listing all the registered users of DocMaster, the unclassified National Security Agency computer system that Lenny had social engineered himself into when he worked at Hughes Aircraft. Everything in the file was public information, including the lists of telephone extensions at the National Computer Security Center. The prosecutor, who obviously didn't understand what he was looking at, was characterizing public telephone extensions as classified access codes. Unbelievable. Another allegation. The claim that I'd hacked into police computers and deleted my arrest record was related to my Santa Cruz operations hacking case. But the missing record was really law enforcement's own fault. Remember, when Bonnie and I surrendered ourselves to the West Hollywood Sheriff's Department, because they neglected to fingerprint or photograph us, no record was created of our arrest. In short, it was their own screw-up. They didn't do their job. All the other allegations were also false, rehashes of rumors that apparently convinced the magistrate I was a serious threat to national security. The one that mystified me most was that I had repeatedly had the phone service of the actress Christy McNichol turned off because I had a crush on her. First of all, I couldn't imagine why anyone would think that turning off someone's phone would be a good way to demonstrate affection. I never understood how the story got started, but the experience had been seared into my memory. I'd had to endure the humiliation of standing in line at the grocery store and seeing my photo plastered on the cover of the National Examiner alongside florid headlines saying, "I was a crazed stalker obsessed with Christy McNichol." The feeling in the pit of my stomach as I glanced around me, hoping that none of the other shoppers had recognized me on that cover, is one I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. Weeks later, my mom, who then worked at Jerry's Famous Deli in Studio City, saw McNichol having lunch at one of the tables. Mom introduced herself and said, "Kevin Mitnick is my son." McNichol immediately said, "Yeah, what's all this about his turning off my phones?" She said that nothing like that had ever happened to her, and she herself wondered, just as I had, how the rumor had gotten started. Later, a private investigator would confirm that none of it had taken place. When people ask me why I ran, years later, instead of facing the federal charges against me, I think back on moments like this. What good would it do for me to come clean if my accusers were going to play dirty? When there's no presumption of fair treatment and the government is willing to base its charges on superstition and unverified rumors, The only smart response is to run. When it was his turn to present my case, my court-appointed attorney told the magistrate that I had indeed gone to Israel in late 1984, but that I hadn't been absconding, just visiting. I was stunned. We had discussed this point 10 minutes before my hearing, and I'd explained that I hadn't been outside the country in years, and had, in fact, never been overseas. Mom, Graham, and Bonnie all looked shocked because they knew that what he was saying just wasn't true. How could an attorney be so incompetent? In a last-ditch effort to frighten the magistrate, Leon Weidman made one of the most outrageous statements that have probably ever been uttered by a federal prosecutor in court. He told Magistrate Tessopoulos that I could start a nuclear holocaust. "He can whistle into a telephone and launch a nuclear missile from NORAD," he said. Where could he have possibly come up with that ridiculous notion? NORAD computers aren't even connected to the outside world, and they obviously don't use the public telephone lines for issuing launch commands. His other claims, every single one of which was false, were tall tales likely picked up from bogus media reports and who knows what other sources. But I had never heard this NORAD one before, not even in a science fiction story. I can only think he picked up the notion from the Hollywood hit movie War Games. Later, it would become widely accepted that War Games was partly based on my exploits. It wasn't. Prosecutor Weidman was painting a portrait of me as the Lex Luthor of the computer world, which I guess made him Superman. The whistling into the phone thing was so far-fetched that I actually laughed out loud when he said it, certain that Her Honor would tell the man he was being absurd. Instead, she ordered me held without bail because when armed with a keyboard, armed, I posed a danger to the community. And she added that I was to be held where I would not have any access to a telephone. The living areas assigned to a prison's general population have phones that inmates can use to make collect calls. There is only one area with no phone access at all. Solitary confinement, known as the hole. In Time magazine's issue of January 9, 1989, an item under the heading of Technology noted, "Even the most dangerous criminal suspects are usually allowed access to a telephone, but not Kevin Mitnick, or at least not without being under a guard's eye, and then he is permitted to call only his wife, mother, and lawyer. The reason is that putting a phone in Mitnick's hands is like giving a gun to a hitman. The 25-year-old sometime college student is accused by federal officials of using the phone system to become one of the most formidable computer break-in artists of all time." Like giving a gun to a hitman. Said of a guy whose only weapons were computer code and social engineering. I would have another chance to plead my case. The hearing before a magistrate concerns only the initial decision about detention. In the federal system, you then go to the wheel, and a federal judge is assigned to your case at random, thus the wheel. I was told I was lucky to get Judge Mariana Falzer. Not quite. The new attorney who had been assigned to me, Alan Rubin, tried to argue that I shouldn't be housed in solitary confinement, which was intended for inmates who committed violent acts in prison or were a threat to the prison itself. Judge Falzer said, "That's exactly where he belongs." Now I was taken to the brand new, just opened Federal Metropolitan Detention Center in downtown Los Angeles, where I was escorted up to the 8th floor, Unit 8 North, and introduced to my new home, a space about 8 feet by 10, dimly lit, with one narrow vertical slit of a window through which I could see cars, the train station, people walking around free, and the Metro Plaza Hotel, in which, seedy though it probably was, I longed to be. I couldn't even see the guards or other prisoners, since I was closed in not by bars, but by a steel door with a slot that my food trays were slid through. The loneliness was mind-numbing. Prisoners who have to stay in the hole for extended periods often lose contact with reality. Some never recover, living the rest of their lives in a dim never-never land, unable to function in society, unable to hold a job. To get an idea of what it's like, picture being trapped for 23 hours a day in a closet lit by only a single 40-watt bulb. Whenever I left my cell, even to walk just 10 feet to the shower, I had to be shackled in leg irons and handcuffs, treated the same way as a prisoner who had violently assaulted a guard. For exercise, I would be shuffled once a day to a kind of outdoor cage, not much more than twice the size of my cell, where for an hour I could breathe fresh air and do a few push-ups. How did I survive? Visits from my mom, dad, grandmother, and wife were all I had to look forward to. Keeping my mind active was my salvation. Since I wasn't in the hole for violating prison rules, the strict guidelines for prisoners in solitary were relaxed a little for me. I could read books and magazines, write letters, listen to my Walkman radio, favorites KNX 1070 News Radio and classic rock. But writing was difficult because I was allowed only a short pencil, too stubby to use for more than a few minutes at a time. But even in solitary, in spite of the court's best efforts, I managed to do a bit of phone freaking. I was allowed phone calls to my attorney, my mom, my dad, and Aunt Chickie, as well as to Bonnie, but only when she was at home at her apartment, not at work. Sometimes I'd long to talk to her during the day. In order to make a call, I had to be shackled and walked to a hallway that had a bank of 3 payphones. The guard would take the restraints off once we reached the phone area and would sit in a chair 5 feet away, facing the wall of phones. Calling anyone not listed in the court order would seem impossible, short of trying to bribe the guard, and I knew that would be a shortcut to getting the few privileges I did have revoked. But wasn't there some way I could call Bonnie at work? I concocted a plan. It would take balls, but what did I have to lose? I was already in solitary confinement, a supposed threat to national security. I was already at the bottom of the barrel. I told the guard, "I want to call my mother," and he looked up the number in the logbook. He walked the few steps, dialed the phone, and handed it to me. The operator came on and asked my name, then went off the line until my mom answered and agreed to accept a collect call from Kevin, and we were finally connected. As I was talking with Mom, I would frequently rub my back against the payphone as if I had an itch. At the end of our conversation, I would then put one hand behind my back, acting like I was scratching my back. With my hand still behind me while continuing to talk as if carrying on a conversation, I would hold down the switch hook for a few seconds to disconnect the call. Then I would bring my hand back around in front of my body. I knew I had only 18 seconds to dial a new number before the phone would start emitting a loud, fast, busy signal that the guard would surely be able to hear. So I'd reach behind my back again and pretend to scratch while I very quickly dialed whatever number I wanted to call, beginning with 0 to make it a collect call. I would pace back and forth while scratching my back so the guard would get used to this action and not think it was suspicious. Of course, I couldn't see the dial pad, so I had to be sure to get the numbers right without having to look. And I had to hold the phone tightly against my ear to mask the sound of the touch tones as I redialed. All the while, I had to act as if I were still talking to my mother, so I would nod and appear to be holding a conversation with her as the guard watched. After I punched in the new number, I had to time my fake conversation just right, so that when the operator came on and said, "Collect call, who shall I say is the caller?" the next word I said would be "Kevin," in a sentence that would sound normal to the guard. As the operator asked my name, I'd be saying something like, "Well, tell Uncle John that..." The operator would stop talking and wait for me to give my name, just as I was saying, "Kevin sends my best." When I heard Bonnie's voice, my heart soared. It took willpower to control myself, forcing myself to talk with no more animation than when I really was talking to my mother. It had worked. I was as excited as if I'd just succeeded with some epic hack. The first time is the hardest. I kept up that routine day after day. It's a wonder the guard didn't buy me some lotion for itchy skin. One night, a couple of weeks after I began doing this trick, when I was sleeping, my cell door slid open. Standing there were a bunch of suits, a couple of associate wardens, and the captain of the detention center. I was handcuffed, shackled, and hustled off to a conference room 30 feet away. I sat down and one of the associate wardens asked, "Mitnick, how are you doing it? How are you redialing the phone?" I played dumb. thinking it would be stupid to admit anything. Let them prove it. The captain chimed in. We've been monitoring your calls. How are you dialing the phone? The CO, correctional officer, is watching you at all times. I smiled and said, I'm not David Copperfield. How could I possibly redial the phone? The officer never takes his eyes off me. 2 days later, I heard noises outside my room. It was a Pacific Bell technician. What the hell? He was installing a phone jack in the hallway across from my cell, and the next time I asked to make a phone call, I found out why. The guard brought a phone with a 20-foot handset cord and plugged it into the jack, dialed the authorized number I requested, and then passed the handset through the slot in the heavy metal door to my cell. The phone itself was far beyond my reach. Bastards! Besides taking my phone calls, Bonnie was also very supportive in person. 3 times a week after work, she'd make the long drive to the prison and wait in line for a very long time for her turn to see me in the visiting room, with guards watching us the whole time. We were allowed a brief hug and quick kiss. Over and over, I would earnestly reassure her that this was the last time I would ever do anything like this. As in the past, I really believed it. I continued to sit in solitary while attorney Alan Rubin negotiated with the prosecutor about the terms of a plea bargain that would let me get out of prison without a trial. I was being charged with breaking into DEC and possessing MCI access codes, causing DEC a loss of $4 million, an absurd claim. Digital's actual losses were related to the investigation of the incident. The $4 million figure was an arbitrary number chosen for the purpose of sentencing me to a lengthy prison term under the federal sentencing guidelines. My punishment should really have been based on the cost of the licensing fees I hadn't paid for the source code I'd copied, which would have been much, much less. Still, I wanted to settle the case and get out of my coffin-like cell as quickly as possible. I didn't want to stand trial because I knew the feds had easily enough evidence to convict me. They had my notes and discs. They had Lenny's eagerness to testify against me. They had the tape from a body wire Lenny had worn during our last hacking session. At last, my attorney worked out a deal with the federal prosecutors that would result in my serving a 1-year prison term. They also wanted me to testify against Lenny. That came as a shock, since I'd always heard that the guy who squealed first would get off easy, maybe without even doing any time at all. But the feds now wanted to nail their own snitch and my former friend. Sure, I said. Lenny had given evidence against me, so why shouldn't I pay him back in kind? But when we got into court, Judge Falzer apparently was influenced by the many rumors and false allegations that had piled up against me over time. She rejected the plea agreement, deeming it too lenient. Still, she allowed a revised version that gave me 1 year in jail, followed by 6 months in a halfway house. I was also required to sit down with DEC's Andy Goldstein to tell him how we'd hacked into DEC and copied its most coveted source code. As soon as I said I would accept a plea agreement, I magically lost my national security threat status. I was transferred from solitary into the general population. At first, it felt almost as good as being released, but then reality quickly reminded me that I was still in jail. While I was in the general population at the Metropolitan Detention Center, a fellow prisoner, a Colombian drug lord, offered to pay me $5 million cash if I could hack into Sentry, the Federal Bureau of Prisons computer system, and get him released. I played along to keep on friendly terms with him, but I had absolutely no intention of going down that road. Soon, I was transferred to the federal prison camp at Lompoc. What a difference. There was dormitory housing instead of cells and not even a fence around the place. I was sharing my new digs with the who's who of white-collar crime. My fellow inmates even included a former federal judge who had been convicted of tax evasion. My weight had spiked back up to 240 while I was in solitary, since I had been living mostly on comfort food from the commissary, goodies like Hershey bars dipped in peanut butter. Hey, when you're in solitary, anything that makes you feel a little better is a good thing, right? But now, at Lompoc, another inmate, a cool guy named Roger Wilson, talked me into doing lots of walking and exercising as well as eating healthier foods such as rice and veggies and the like. It was hard for me to get started, but with his encouragement, I succeeded. It was the beginning of a change in my lifestyle that would remake me, at least in terms of my body image. Once, when I was sitting on a wooden bench waiting in line to use the phone, Ivan Boesky sat down next to me with a coffee in hand. Everybody knew who he was, a one-time billionaire financial genius who had been convicted of insider trading. And it turned out he knew who I was, too.
"Hey, Mitnick," he said, "how much money did you make hacking those computers?"
"I didn't do it for the money. I did it for the entertainment," I replied. He said something like, "You're in prison and you didn't make any money? Isn't that stupid?" Like he was looking down his nose at me. At that exact moment, I happened to spot a roach floating in his coffee. Smiling, I pointed at it and said, "This place isn't like the Helmsley, is it?" Boesky never answered. He just got up and walked away. After almost 4 months at Lompoc, I was coming up for release to the halfway house, a place called Beit Teshuvah. I was told the name was Hebrew for House of Return. Beit Teshuvah used the 12-step program designed for people with drug, alcohol, and other addictions. My imminent move to a halfway house was the good news. The bad news was that a probation officer had called Bonnie to make an appointment to inspect the apartment she was then living in, explaining that he had to approve my future living arrangements before I was released. For Bonnie, that was the last straw. She felt she had been through enough and couldn't dance this dance anymore. "You don't need to inspect my apartment," she told the guy. "My husband won't be living here." On her next visit, she gave me the bad news. She was filing for divorce. She now says, "It was a very painful time for me. I thought I had failed. It was scary. I was too afraid to leave Kevin, but too afraid to stay. The fear of staying just became too big." I was stunned. We had been planning to spend the rest of our lives together, and now she had changed her mind just as I was nearing release. I felt as if a ton of bricks had been dropped on me. I was really hurt and totally shocked. Bonnie agreed to come to the halfway house for a couple of marriage counseling sessions with me. They didn't help. I was deeply disappointed about her decision to end our marriage. What could account for her sudden change of heart? There must be another guy, I thought. Somebody else was in the picture. I figured that by checking out the messages on her answering machine, I could find out who it was. I felt bad about doing it, but I needed to know the truth. I knew Bonnie's answering machine was a Radio Shack product because I recognized the jingle it played to prompt the caller to leave a message. I also knew that with this particular machine, you could retrieve messages remotely, but only if you had the handheld device that came with it, which emitted a special set of tones to turn on the playback. How could I get around that and listen to her messages without the remote beeper? I called a Radio Shack store and described the type of answering machine she had, then added that I had lost my beeper and needed to buy another. The salesman said there were 4 possible beepers for the various models of that particular answering machine, A, B, C, and D, each of which played a different sequence of tones. I said, "I'm a musician, so I've got a good ear." He wanted me to come down to the store, but I couldn't leave the halfway house because new arrivals weren't permitted to leave the premises for the first 30 days they were there. I pleaded with him to open one of each type, put batteries in the remotes, and then play each remote so I could hear it. My persistence paid off. The guy went to the trouble of setting up the 4 remotes and playing each of their tones for me. I had a micro cassette tape recorder running the whole time, pressed to the telephone receiver. Afterward, I called Bonnie's phone and played back the tones through the receiver. The 3rd one did the trick. I heard Bonnie leave a message on her own phone, presumably from work. After the call had gone to the machine, some guy in her apartment picked up, and the tape recorded both sides of their conversation as she told him about how great it was to spend time with you. Eavesdropping on her messages was a stupid thing for me to do because it just made the pain I was already feeling that much worse, but it confirmed my suspicions. I was pretty upset that she had been lying to me. I was desperate enough to actually consider sneaking out of the halfway house to see her, Luckily, I stopped myself knowing what a huge mistake that would be. After that first month, I was allowed to leave the halfway house for some selected appointments and visits. I often went to see Bonnie, trying to win her back. On one of those visits, I noticed that she'd carelessly left her latest phone bill sitting on the table. It showed that she'd been spending hours on the phone with Louis DePayne, who until that moment I'd still believed was my closest friend. Well, of course, I had to find out for sure. I casually asked if she ever heard from any of my buddies, like Louis. She lied, flatly denying having ever been in touch with him at all and confirming my worst fear. In my mind, she had completely blindsided me. Where were the faith and trust that I thought I had finally found in her? I confronted her but got nowhere. I was devastated. Licking my wounds, I walked out and cut off all contact with her for a long time. Soon after, she moved in with Louis. To me, it made no sense at all. She was leaving a guy with a hacking addiction for another guy with the same propensities. But more important was that Bonnie hadn't been just my girlfriend. She had been my wife. And now she'd taken up with my best friend. After my release, I traded my hacking addiction for an addiction of a different kind. I became an obsessive gym rat, working out for hours every day. I was also able to find a short-term job as a tech support person for a firm called Case Care, but that lasted only 3 months. When it ended, I obtained permission from the probation officer to relocate to Las Vegas, where my mom had moved and would welcome me living with her until I could get my own place. Over a period of months, I dropped 100 pounds. That put me in the best shape of my life, and I wasn't hacking. I was feeling great, and if you had asked me then, I would have said the hacking days were all behind me. That was what I thought. 9. The Kevin Mitnick Discount Plan. Imagine a trade show floor with 2 million square feet of space, packed with 200,000 people crammed wall to wall, sounding like they're all talking at once, mostly in Japanese, Taiwanese, and Mandarin. That's what the Las Vegas Convention Center was like in 1991 during CES, the annual Consumer Electronics Show, a candy store drawing one of the biggest crowds in the world. I had traveled across town to be there one day during the show, but not just to visit the booths or see the new electronic gadgets that would dazzle buyers the next Christmas. I was there for the background noise. It was essential for an air of believability on the phone call I was about to place. This was the challenge. I had a Novatel PTR 825 cell phone, which back then was one of the hottest phones on the market. I wanted to feel safe talking to my friends on it and not have to wonder if somebody from the FBI or local law enforcement was listening in. I knew a way that might be possible. Now I was trying to find out if what I had in mind could really work. My plan was based on a trick involving the phone's electronic serial number, or ESN. As every phone hacker knows, each cell phone has a unique ESN, which gets transmitted along with the mobile phone number, or MIN, to the nearest cell tower. It's part of how the cell phone company validates that a caller is a legitimate subscriber, and part of how it knows whom to charge calls to. If I could keep changing my phone so it would transmit the MINs and ESNs of legitimate subscribers, then my calls would be completely safe. Every attempt to trace a call would lead to some stranger, the person who owned the real phone associated with the ESN that I was using at the moment. Okay, the customer would also have to explain to the phone company that he hadn't made the extra calls he was being charged for, but he wouldn't be responsible for paying the charges for those unauthorized calls. From a convention center payphone, I dialed a number in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. "Novatel," a lady's voice came down the line. "Hi," I said. "I need to talk to someone in engineering." "Where are you calling from?" she wanted to know. As always, I had done my research. "I'm with engineering in Fort Worth." "You should be speaking to the engineering manager, Fred Walker, but he's not in today. Can I take your number and have Mr. Walker call you tomorrow?" "It's urgent," I said. "Let me speak to whoever's available in his department." Moments later, a man with a Japanese accent came on the line and gave his name as Kumamoto. "Kumamoto-san, this is Mike Bishop from Fort Worth," I said, using the name I had read off a Consumer Electronics Show electronic message board only moments earlier. I usually talk to Fred Walker, but he's not in. I'm at CES in Vegas. I was counting on the actual background noise to lend credence to the claim. We're doing some testing for a demonstration. Is there a way to change the ESN from the phone's keypad?
Absolutely not. It's against FCC regulations.
That was a bummer. My great idea had just gotten shot down. No, wait, Kumamoto-san was still talking.
We do have a special version of the firmware, version 1.05. It lets you change the ESN from the phone keypad if you know the secret programming steps.
Suddenly I was back in the game. A phone's firmware is its operating system, embedded on a special kind of computer chip called an EEPROM. The trick at a moment like this is not to let your excitement come through in your voice. I asked a question that would sound like a challenge. Why does it allow changing the ESN?
The FCC requires it for testing, he said.
How can I get a copy? I thought maybe he'd say he would send me a phone with that version of the firmware.
I can send the chip, he said. You can replace it in the phone.
Fantastic. This might be even better than getting a whole new phone if I could just push the guy a little further. Can you burn 4 or 5 of the EEPROMs for me?
Yes.
Excellent, but now I had hit a snag. How was I going to have them sent to me without giving my real name and a delivery address that could be tracked? Burn them for me, I told him. I'll call you back. I was pretty sure those chips would make me the only person outside Novatel who could change the number of his Novatel cell phone just by pressing the buttons on his keypad. Not only would it let me talk for free, but it would give me a cloak of invisibility, guaranteeing my conversations would be private. And it would also give me a safe callback number anytime I wanted to social engineer a target company. But how was I going to get that package sent to me without being caught? If you were in my shoes at this point, how would you arrange to get hold of those chips? Think about it for a minute. The answer wasn't all that hard. It was in two parts, and it came to me in an instant. I called Novatel again and asked for the secretary to Kumamoto-san's manager, Fred Walker. I told her, Kumamoto-san from engineering is going to drop off something for me. I'm working with our people at the booth at CES, but I'm here in Calgary for the day. I'll come by and pick it up this afternoon. Kumamoto-san was already busy burning the chips for me when I got him back on the phone and asked him to pack them up when they were ready and drop them off with Walker's secretary. After spending a couple of hours wandering the convention floor, soaking up what was new in the world of electronics and cell phones, I was ready for my next step. About 20 minutes before quitting time, Calgary is an hour ahead of Las Vegas, I got the secretary on the phone again. I'm at the airport on the way back to Las Vegas unexpectedly. They were having problems at the booth. That package Kumamoto-san left for me, can you FedEx it to my hotel there? I'm staying at Circus Circus. I had already made a reservation for the next day at Circus Circus under the name Mike Bishop. The clerk hadn't even asked for a credit card. I gave the secretary the address of the hotel and spelled the Mike Bishop name just to be sure she had it right. One more phone call, again to Circus Circus. I explained I would be arriving late and needed to make sure the front desk would hold a FedEx that would be delivered before I checked in. Certainly, Mr. Bishop, if it's a large item, the bell captain will have it in the storage room. If it's small, we'll be holding it here at the registration desk. No problem. For the next call, I found my way to a quiet area and punched in the number for my favorite Circuit City store. When I reached a clerk in the cell phone department, I said, "This is Steve Walsh, LA Cellular. We've been having computer failures in our activation system. Have you activated any phones on LA Cellular in the last 2 hours?" "Yes, the store had sold 4. "Well, look," I said, "I need you to read me the mobile number and the ESN of each of those phones so I can reactivate their numbers in the system. The last thing we need is unhappy customers, right?" I gave him a sarcastic chuckle and he read off the numbers. So now I had 4 ESNs and the phone numbers that went with them. For the rest of the afternoon, the wait was absolutely nerve-wracking. I had no idea whether or not I would be able to pull this off. Would the Novatel people sense that something fishy was up and never send the chips? Would there be FBI agents staked out in the hotel lobby waiting to pick me up? Or would I, by the next afternoon, have the capability of changing the number of my cell phone as often as I wanted?
The next day, my longtime friend Alex Kasparovicius arrived. An intelligent, friendly guy, expert in IT and telephone systems, Alex liked the adventure of being included in some of my exploits, but he wasn't really a hacking partner. I could doggedly stick to an effort for months and months until I finally succeeded. Alex wasn't like that. He had other distractions. He kept busy working as a camp counselor in Griffith Park, playing classical music on his French horn, and looking for new girlfriends. I filled him in on the situation. What a kick I got out of watching his reaction. At first not believing it would be possible to get the manufacturer to send us the chips, then imagining how great it would be if we could really make calls masking our identities. Kumamoto-san had provided me with the programming instructions for giving the phone a new ESN using the special version of the firmware. Today, almost 20 years later, I can still remember the exact code. It was function-key, function-key, pound symbol, 39, pound symbol, last eight digits of the new ESN, pound symbol, function-key. For the technically curious, the ESN is actually 11 decimal digits long, the first three of which designate the phone's manufacturer. With the chip in the code, I would only be able to reprogram any Novatel ESN into my phone, but not one from another cell phone manufacturer. Though, later on, when I got Novatel's source code, I would gain that capability as well. By 3 o'clock p.m., we were pretty sure Federal Express would have delivered to Circus Circus already, and we couldn't keep our impatience under control any longer. Alex volunteered to do the pickup, understanding without conversation that if I went in and there were cops waiting, I'd be on my way back to prison. I told him to give the name Mike Bishop, say he had to get the package directly over to the convention center, and would be back later to register. I stayed out front. In a situation like this, there was always a chance that someone could have seen through the ruse and alerted the feds. We both knew that Alex could be heading into a trap. From the moment he walked in, he'd have to be scoping out the place for people who could be plainclothes cops, but he couldn't be looking up and down every man and every woman who seemed to be just passing the time. That would be too suspicious. He had to scan. I knew Alex was too cool to look over his shoulder or show any sign that he was nervous. If there was anything that looked wrong, he'd walk right out, not in an obvious hurry, but not dawdling either. With every minute that ticked by, I got more anxious. How long could it take to pick up a small package? Okay, I thought, calm down. There are probably a lot of people in line at the registration desk, and he has to wait his turn. More minutes ticked by. I was beginning to think I'd have to walk in myself and see if there was a crowd of cops, or maybe ask a casino guest if there had been some kind of police action a few minutes before. But there he was, coming out the door, sauntering casually over to me with a huge grin on his face. Filled with anticipation, heart pumping, we stood right there on the street and opened the package. Inside, a clear white case contained, as promised, five cell phone 27C512 EPROMs. I had been social engineering for years, but this was probably my biggest prize ever up to that time. If, that is, the chips really worked. We crossed Las Vegas Boulevard to the Peppermill, avoiding the tourist-filled cocktail lounge with its sexy waitresses, in favor of a booth in the restaurant area where we would be less conspicuous. Louis DePayne joined us. Yes, the guy who was now my ex-wife's lover. I'm not sure I can explain why I kept in contact with Louis after he stole my wife. Obviously, I never trusted or respected him again, but frankly, there were so few people I dared to stay in touch with at all that I needed someone who understood my predicament, and who could understand it better than Louis. He had been my hacking buddy from the start. We'd been through a lot together. It would have been easy to think of him with bitterness as my arch enemy. He certainly qualified. But at the same time, he was also genuinely one of my best friends. And Bonnie was another. Eventually, I had moved past the pain and begun seeing them again. We gradually became friends, like those divorced couples with kids who end up having picnics together with their new spouses on family holidays. We're often advised to forgive and forget. In this case, forgiveness may be too strong a word. I had to let go of the resentment for my own sake, but I couldn't afford to forget. Although Lewis was a good hacking partner, and I valued his skill set, I hacked with him only when I had a failsafe, when we both stood to lose if he tried to turn me in. Under these new conditions, Lewis and I had resumed our hacking together and created a new version of our old friendship that had changed forever. Now, in our booth in the pepper mill, I thought Lewis's eyes were going to pop out of his head when he saw those chips. He sat down without fanfare and started disassembling my phone, carefully arranging its parts on the table and jotting the details on a notepad so he'd know where each belonged when he was ready to put them all back together. In less than 5 minutes, Lewis had the phone taken apart, down to the circuit board, revealing the chip held in place by a ZIF, zero insertion force socket. I handed him one of the new chips. He slipped it into place and began his careful reassembly. I didn't want to say anything that would throw him off, but I was growing antsy, wishing he'd work just a little faster so I could find out if we had hit a gold mine or not. As soon as it was completely together, I snatched the phone from him and punched in the function code that Kumamoto-san had given me. For this test, I programmed the ESN and changed the phone number to match the ones for Lewis's phone. The phone turned itself off and rebooted. I could feel my every heartbeat at the front of my scalp. All three of our heads were bent over the table, focused on the phone's little screen. The display lit with the startup screen. I punched in the function to display the phone's ESN. The numbers that appeared were the ones for the ESN I had entered. The three of us sent up a cheer, not caring that other customers were turning to stare. It worked! It really worked! Back then, some phone companies had a number you could call to get the accurate time. I punched in 213-853-1212 and put the phone down on the table. All three of us heard it together, that recorded lady's voice saying, "At the tone, the time will be." My phone was now successfully making outgoing calls as a clone of Lewis's, and the cell phone company would record these calls as having been made not by me, but by Lewis from his own phone. I had social engineered Novatel and gained huge power. I could make phone calls that couldn't be traced back to me. But I had just fallen off the wagon for this one hack. Or was I back into hacking all over again? At that moment, I could not have said for sure. What I did know, though, was that I had achieved invisibility. 10. Mystery Hacker. "You look amazing," she answered. "You look amazing, too." What a boost to my ego. No one had ever said anything like that to me before, not even Bonnie, and certainly not an extremely hot chick like this one, with a body, face, and hair that made me picture her on stage in a casino somewhere, strutting in high heels in a skimpy costume, or half a costume. She was pumping on a Stairmaster 6000, hard enough to work up a sweat. I climbed onto the one adjacent and struck up a conversation. She was friendly enough to give me hope. It didn't last. She said she was a dancer with Siegfried and Roy, that pair of famous magicians who were doing large-scale illusions and working with live tigers in their act. Wouldn't I love to know how they did some of their tricks? Any magician would. I started asking questions. She gave me this cold, "fuck you" look and said, "I had to sign a confidentiality agreement. I can't tell you anything." She was nice about it, but firm. The go-away message was all too clear. Damn. My cell phone rang, providing a handy escape from the embarrassment. "Hey, Kevin," the voice said. "Hi, Adam, my half-brother. The person in the world I was closest to who wasn't a hacker. In fact, he didn't even use a computer." After we had chatted for a bit, he said, "An ex-girlfriend of mine knows this big super hacker named Eric Hines. She says he knows some phone company stuff you might not know about, and he told her he really needs to talk to you." And then he said, "Be careful, Kevin. I don't think this girl is trustworthy." My first reaction to Adam's call was to blow off the whole thing, just not follow up. I'd had enough problems, even hacking with guys I had known for years and felt I could trust. But resisting temptation had never been one of my virtues. I called the number Adam had given me. The phone was answered not by Eric, but by a guy who said his name was Henry Spiegel. Spiegel was one of the most colorful characters I've ever run across, and my list includes, besides Ivan Boesky, people like famed Palimony attorney Marvin Mitchelson, convicted of tax evasion, and ZZZZ best scammer Barry Minkow. Spiegel was a case all his own, a guy who had a reputation for being on the periphery of everything from bank robbery to porno to ownership of a hot new Hollywood nightclub, one of those written about places where young actors and wannabes line up outside every night. When I asked Spiegel to put Eric on the phone, he said, "I'll get him for you. I'll have to page him and then conference you in. He's really cautious." Cautious? I was cautious. This guy sounded way beyond that, more like super paranoid. I waited. What was I doing anyway? If this guy was really into hacking, even talking to him on the phone was a bad idea for me. The terms of my release said I couldn't have any contact with hackers, and associating with DePayne was risky enough. One word from this Eric Hines guy could be enough to send me back to a prison cell for up to another 2 years. Except for the Novotel cell phone hack, I had been mostly playing by the rules for the 2 years I had been back on the street. I had only another year of supervised release left, so why had I made this call? Here I was, getting in touch with Eric while telling myself I was doing it out of courtesy to my half-brother. How could I have known that this one innocent call would be the beginning of an insane adventure that would change my life forever? When Eric came on the phone that first time, he busied himself by dropping enough hints to make sure I understood he knew a lot about phone freaking and computer hacking. He said something like, "I've been working with Kevin, you know, the other one, Kevin Poulsen. He was trying to build cred with me on the shoulders of a hacker who had just been busted for rigging radio contests and supposedly stealing national security secrets. He told me, I've been on break-ins to telco offices with him." If it was true that he had been inside telephone company offices, that was really interesting. It meant Eric had inside information from actually using and controlling the equipment in central offices and other telco facilities. So he definitely had my attention. Eric's claim of knowing a bunch of Poulsen's tactics was good bait. To set the hook, he sprinkled his gab with details about phone company switches like the 1A ESS, 5E, and DMS-100, and talked about systems like Cosmos, Mizar, Elmos, and the bank's network, which he said he and Poulsen had accessed remotely. I could tell he wasn't just bluffing his way through. He knew more than a little about how the systems worked, and he made it sound like he had been part of the small team that had worked with Poulsen to rig those radio contests, which newspaper articles said Poulsen had won a couple of Porsches from. We talked for about 10 minutes. Over the next week or so, I called Spiegel a few more times for conversations with Eric. A couple of things nagged at my gut. Eric didn't talk like other hackers. He sounded more like Joe Friday, like a cop. He asked questions like, "What projects have you been up to lately? Who are you talking with these days?" Asking a hacker that kind of stuff was a little like going into a bar where bank robbers hung out and saying to one of them, "Ernie sent me. Who'd you pull your last job with?" I told him, "I'm not hacking anymore." "Neither am I," he said. This was pretty much the standard cover-your-ass line with somebody you didn't know. Of course he was lying, and he meant for me to know it. He must have figured I was lying, too. In my case, the statement was pretty much true, but thanks to this guy, it wouldn't be for long. I told him, "There's a friend of mine I think you'd like to talk to. His name is Bob. What number should I have him call you at?" "Tell him to call Henry the same way you just did," he said. "He'll conference me in again." Bob was my on-the-spur-of-the-moment alias for Louis DePayne. It would have been hard to find another hacker with Eric's inside information. Yes, I was drawing Louis even deeper into my hacking, but with him acting as my front guy, I could find out what information Eric had that Louis and I didn't while still protecting myself. Why was I willing to be tempted into exchanging information with Eric, when for me to even talk with him violated my terms of release? Think of it like this. I was living in Las Vegas, a city I didn't know well and didn't much like. I kept driving past the gaudy hotels and casinos, all tarted up to draw the tourists and gamblers. For me, this was no fun town. There was no sunshine in my life. None of the thrill and intellectual challenge I'd experienced when hacking into the phone companies. None of that adrenaline flow from finding software flaws.